mornings, I'm Chris Oakes, and coming up, it's primary election day with a special edition of the program. As voters head to the polls, we recap our candidate forum series featuring the individuals running in contested races locally. For Hancock County Prosecutor Heather Pendleton and Sean Abbott, for County Commissioner Jeff Wobser, Jeff Hunker, and Holly Frischi, for Hancock County Sheriff Mark Price, Mike Cortez, and Daniel Harmon. And of course, the heated race for the GOP nomination in the 83rd Ohio House District seat, John Cross and Ty Matthews. This is the Good Mornings Podcast Edition for Tuesday, March 19th, 2024. So if the election today does not go your way, you may be a little angry about that. You may be a little frustrated. You may want to vent a little bit. But wait, maybe just stepping back and taking a deep breath would be healthier for you. A new study from The Ohio State University finds that breathing, not venting, works better to soothe anger. And whether it's the election or whether it's, you know, just something that happens at work today, I think we've all had those days. Maybe it's an argument with your significant other, your kids, whatever. We've all had those moments where we go to a friend and say, I just have to vent. Well, maybe that's not the healthiest option. Researchers analyzed data from over 10,000 people and found that deep breathing, mindfulness, meditation, yoga, and counting to 10 all worked better than a long chat with your best friend. Some activities, like jogging, actually rev anger up. That's the other thing that sometimes people will do to burn off some steam and vent a little bit. I just need to go for a run and get this energy out. But that, in some cases, can actually increase your anger level. To reduce anger, it is better to engage in activities that decrease arousal levels, according to the senior study author, Brad Bushman, from Ohio State. Despite what popular wisdom may suggest, blowing off steam is not an effective strategy because it increases your arousal levels. So, just something to keep in mind. It is not all it's cracked up to be, apparently. Blowing off some steam. So just something to keep in mind if the election results don't go your way tonight, or if you have something happen during the course of the day, or you're talking politics with a friend and it gets a little heated. Yeah, we've all had it happen. So originating the program from the home studio once again this morning, I can think of no better day to be safely ensconced in the bunker than election day. Insulated and protected from the rest of the world. But we're actually at home yesterday in the bunker as well, doing the show. And I have to admit, after the program was over yesterday, I did nothing. I, you know, of course, got up, did the program, got ready for today's show after the program was over yesterday. And then after that, I plopped down on the couch and did absolutely nothing yesterday. Had one of those couch rotting days. You've heard of that term, couch rotting or bed rotting. They call it is the act of spending all day bundled up, nothing on the agenda, just munching on snacks and watching the old boob tube. It is the hot thing on social media. Social media has taken this by storm. But is it bad for you? Well, experts say that a duvet day, just watching TV and resting, can actually be healthy. But a bed-rotting session or a couch-rotting session should not span multiple days. This, they say, could be a sign of another problem, a deeper problem like depression or burnout. While there is nothing wrong with bed-rotting every now and then to recharge your batteries, doing this frequently, which they defined as three times a week or more, is a sign that your nervous system is actively shutting down. Experts also recommend being aware of excessive social media use and food intake during these duvet days. So that from stress-relieving coach Liz Tenuto says so. One day of bed rotting, not a big deal. But if it becomes a habit, that is a big deal. So just something to keep in mind. Some of the other most interesting and buzzworthy stories to get your Tuesday morning started. Now, this is big news. This is really big news. Definitely something that you need to be aware of. Some grape growers in California are destroying their own vines because the demand for wine has decreased. And this is not just in California. This is globally. They're seeing this in Australia and even France as well. South Australian grower Tony Townsend is pulling up his entire 34-acre vineyard. And he's going out of business. He said, "I enjoyed being in the wine industry, but it was just economically unviable to continue." The amount of extra wine in Australia, they say, by the way, equated to 2 years of production. They've got an extra 2 years worth of wine just in storage. Last year, the French government said it would spend $216 million, the equivalent of $216 million, to destroy excess wine in that country. What is this world coming to? Wine consumption increased throughout the 90s, but has been on a steady decline over the past decade. So it is not just the pandemic and post-pandemic where we're not just sitting around with nothing to do on our duvet days, sipping wine. Demand for wine has cooled, and they're actually destroying wine, ripping up the vineyards. What is this world coming to? I think we have some work to do, ladies and gentlemen. It is time to respond. Break out the drink more wine. That's why I hear it saying. We got to save the vineyards. And a couple of other items here. I thought this was kind of interesting. Pope Francis is out with a new memoir, new autobiography. The Pope sharing details of his life in the book Life, My Story Through History. I know it's a real catchy title, right? Probably not the page-turner that the Britney Spears biography was, but it does find the pontiff talking about his 87 years, as revealed to co-author Fabio Marchese Ragona in hours of interviews. Among the revelations, Pope Francis says he is not considering resigning, like his predecessor, Pope Benedict, who retired from the papacy, whereas most popes leave office by death. And Pope Benedict decided to step down and resign. However you want to put it, that apparently is not on Pope Francis's mind. So he's had a few health issues here lately, but don't expect the Pope to retire anytime soon. Life, My Story Through History, the new biography from Pope Francis, if you are interested. And speaking of religious items, I thought this was kind of interesting. And I don't know, maybe it seems odd to say that a church might be cursed, but a historic church in St. Louis has caught fire now for the third time. Firefighters are called to a three-alarm fire yesterday evening at the former St. Augustine Catholic Church. Officials on the scene said that they were preparing for parts of the building to collapse. The church has seen two other fires, the latest just a couple of years ago when the building was being renovated for a nonprofit project. The church is now closed. It's not being used as a church anymore. Remember, there was a story about the historic church in Toledo that had some issues with bricks falling off the facade and all of that, and they're worried about, you know, whether it's still viable, whether it should. So like that church in Toledo, this one in St. Louis is a city landmark and is listed on the National Register of Historic Places, but who knows its future fate at this point. It's been three fires at the former St. Augustine Catholic Church. No official cause of the fire as yet. So the church dates all the way back to 1896. So you can imagine how the residents of the city, particularly the Catholic population of the city of St. Louis, really doesn't want to see the building go, but at this point, it may be a safety issue. Again, certainly not the only city that's dealing with that, but I thought it was an interesting story. There you go. Some of the most interesting and buzzworthy stories to get your Tuesday morning started.
WFIN News, I'm Matt Demchek. Your WTOL 11 weather. It'll be mostly cloudy today and breezy with a high around 50. Becoming partly cloudy tonight, low in the mid-30s. A lot of severe weather recently blew through Ohio, and the Better Business Bureau of Ohio says scammers tend to prey on those who are impacted by severe weather. And the BBB has some tips on those looking to hire a contractor.
Research the businesses thoroughly. Get at least three estimates and ensure that all agreements are documented in writing. Resist high-pressure sales tactics and pay with a credit card. Ask about policy coverage, any specific filing requirements that you may have. Make sure that you save all receipts. And this includes receipts for food, temporary lodging, or even other expenses that may be covered under a policy. And request contractor recommendations from the insurance company itself.
The National Weather Service said an EF1 tornado touched down in southwest Hancock County last week, severely damaging some homes and barns. Ohio's primary election is today, and many Ohioans won't be heading to the polls today because they voted early.
Data from the Secretary of State's office shows more than 495,000 voters across the state cast early ballots. 281,000 of them voted by mail. Nearly 213,000 voted in person at their County Board of Elections office. I'm Colin Dorsey.
The city of Findlay is letting people know that projects are causing some road closures across Findlay this week. Among the closures, Putnam Street will be closed through traffic from Western Avenue to Ports Avenue for curb replacement. And Ports Avenue will be closed to through traffic from Sandusky to West Main Cross for curb replacement. Get the full list of projects in the story on our website. Today's the grand opening for Findlay's first Raising Cane's restaurant. Raising Cane says it doesn't hold back on its grand opening celebrations and says it'll be a fun time. To celebrate the day, Raising Cane's is hosting a variety of activities for the community. And you can see that full list of activities in the story on our website. The Findlay Police Department will have officers on site to help with traffic control. Raising Cane's is located in front of the Findlay Village Mall. Don't forget, you can always get more news online anytime at WFIN.com.
So, of course, today is primary election day in the state of Ohio. And there are locally a couple of issues on the ballot that voters of both parties will see. And there are a number of uncontested races, of course, as there always are. Of course, the presidential race has already been decided. But there are several races that will have multiple candidates on the Republican side of the ballot in Hancock County. And over the past several weeks in February and early March, we held a series of candidate forums highlighting those contested races. This morning, in recognition of Election Day, as voters head to the polls, we want to recap those forums and give you one last chance to hear from the candidates. And our first forum this election cycle featured the two candidates vying to be the next county prosecutor, Heather Pendleton and Sean Abbott. Both have experience, both in private practice and as assistant prosecutors. And we asked how each of them relates that experience to the way they would approach the job as the top prosecuting attorney in Hancock County.
As we mentioned, you both have experience as assistant prosecutors. Mr. Abbott has served in that capacity in Fayette County, I believe, correct?
That's correct.
And Ms. Pendleton, of course, serves in that role in Hancock County currently. We'll begin with Ms. Pendleton. Explain the advantages you see in electing someone from inside the current office, elevating someone from inside the current office as the next prosecutor.
Hancock County is roughly 70, just shy of 75,000 people in it, three times the size of a comparable county like Fayette. It presents a lot of different challenges. I will say that Mr. Abbott is correct. The job of the prosecutor is multifaceted. I would never say that it's simply prosecuting criminals because there is a lot of other work that goes into that. It is case review, search warrants, crime scenes, Metrich drug busts, subpoenas, budget commission, one of the little known things that our prosecutor does. There's also a lot of dealings with township trustees and other elected officials that we represent. And each of those is an important facet of the office. I have had experience over the last 7 years. I have actually been really lucky and also grateful to Prosecutor Phil Riegel because he's given me the opportunity to explore and experience each one of those duties of a prosecutor. It is 100 things a day, pulling you in 100 different directions. And it goes on. And I'm 7 years. I'm prepared for the task. I'm up for it. I look forward to it.
Mr. Abbott, similar question. Explain the advantages that you see in electing someone from outside the current office as prosecutor.
Chris, I would say my experiences outside of Hancock County, outside of the Hancock County Prosecutor's Office, are probably my greatest strength. You know, when you're in different locations, you see different attitudes, different cultures, different experiences. You learn what works and what doesn't work. I have practiced in over 20 counties. And I think that's probably the biggest asset that I'll bring to the Hancock County Prosecutor's Office is, you know, a fresh set of eyes, a fresh worldview, a fresh way to look at, you know, how case review comes in, how the cases are processed, you know, how efficient our office is when the case is brought in, to travel through the review process, the indictment process, the arraignment, and then the actual trial or plea when it gets there. And I've seen good attorneys. I've seen bad attorneys. I have seen really good judges. I've seen some bad judges and magistrates. And with those experiences, I bring the good with me. I have, you know, honed the skills that it needs to, you know, be an effective prosecutor, be able to see things in a new light in a different way. When you've been in one place, when you've seen it one way, you only know one way sometimes. You know, when, you know, your only tool is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail.
As you look at the current office of prosecuting attorney, do you see any immediate areas of concern or inefficiency in its operation? And if so, what, if anything, would you do immediately to address those concerns? We'll start with Mr. Abbott.
It's going to be a process. There's going to be a significant evaluation that goes through. We're going to assess every process that we have. You know, we're going to ensure, we're going to learn how the cases come in. We're going to learn, you know, how our trustees send issues to us. We're going to, you know, any issue that comes in, any legal problem that needs to be handled, you know, if it's with the commissioners, if it's with the trustees, if it's with the treasurer and tax foreclosures, if it's with law enforcement, we're going to make sure that we have a streamlined process. You know, in a position like county prosecutor, you live and die by your processes and procedures. And if you've got a bad process, you're going to struggle. You're going to lose cases. You're going to misplace facts. You're going to misplace evidence. And that, you know, is something that simply can't happen. But in addition to that, you know, I think our county prosecutor's office needs to be very, you know, visible and active within the community. And that starts with, you know, being active with our law enforcement, attending the chief's meetings, attending, you know, the harm reduction meetings, meeting with the Adams Board, meeting with our mental health counselors. You know, when I was an assistant prosecutor in Fayette County, we were very proactive when it came to, you know, educating the community. We would write and submit articles to the local newspaper for publication. You know, we wrote articles on teen dating violence. We wrote articles on sexual assaults. We submitted articles on grandparents, you know, rights and what they have and don't have and how they can go about, you know, making a family whole. In addition, you know, we were very proactive about reaching out to our local schools. You know, we would present on the consequences of risky behavior, what the legal ramifications are, what the moral issues are, and what's going to happen if they do it and get caught and come into our office. So I intend to bring that mindset with me as well. We're going to be active. We're going to be visible. We're going to be part of the conversation, part of all of the conversations.
Ms. Pendleton?
Of course, as assistant prosecutor, you know, 7 years I've seen from the inside what goes on in our prosecutor's office. 75,000 people here. I know how it runs. I can see room for improvement, but there is no learning curve with me. I don't have to come in and figure it out. And Prosecutor Regal has already encouraged me to take that by the horns and make it my own. And I appreciate his faith in me that he realizes that Heather Pendleton as prosecutor may not look the same way as Phil Regal as prosecutor, and he's okay with that. We've had that conversation. Many of the programs that Mr. Abbott has referred to already exist in Hancock County. We have a guardian program. We have a program for grandparents. A lot of those things are already happening, the meetings with law enforcement. So I have no learning curve. There is one improvement I would like to make immediately on day one, and that is take our office into the world of technology. That's one thing we don't do well as government. We lag behind because of funding. I am ready to take that on. We've ordered new laptops that are more robust, that can handle a lot of the digital information that's coming into us now. We receive reports digitally. In juvenile court, we even file all of our filings digitally. So I want to bring the other portions of the office up to speed in that area. And I think that would be a world of improvement.
Once again, on this primary election day special edition of the program this morning, we are highlighting, recapping our candidate forum series featuring the individuals who are running in contested races locally, which all happen to be in the Republican primary, of course. And the most highly anticipated candidate forum of this election cycle was the showdown between incumbent John Cross and young upstart challenger Ty Matthews in a heated race for the GOP nomination for the 83rd district seat in the Ohio House of Representatives. As expected, there were fireworks early and often, with the candidates clashing over tax policy, education, abortion, and last year's vote for House Speaker. Here was part of the back and forth, which started as a discussion about the controversy surrounding HB 2.
First of all, I want to say I am not against grant money. I hope those tax dollars come to our district. I really do. But nothing is secured. That process still has to go through the Senate, and it has to go to the governor.
What the House and Senate agreed to, because my opponent wasn't in the room, but the finance chairman of the Senate, the finance chairman of the House were in the room, and the deal was, we'll split it in half. The Senate gets 350, the House gets 350, and we'll start to work on capital budget-like projects. So the good news is we passed House Bill 2, and that's a real, live, living document. And I cannot wait this summer to bring big checks back home and bring your money back home.
And I hope they receive their funding. And to go back to what my opponent just said, there is a memo out here. And it's not, this isn't even my words. This is dated February 7th, 2024, from Senate President Matt Huffman. Quote, "To be clear, there is no such agreement. The bill passed by the House did not include negotiations or discussions with members of the Senate or with the Senate president."
What my opponent is doing is he's falling for the traps. First, when you go to the Ohio House, you don't work for the Ohio Senate. President Huffman can write memos all day long, but I don't pay attention to them, because it's the business of the House to debate and argue and fight for what the Senate may agree or disagree. Senator McCauley and I have a great working relationship. Doesn't mean we always agree on things, but we work things out. We will get this done. We've delivered results since I've been there for 6 years, putting politics aside. and getting people's money back home. This is what it's all about.
There have been accusations that House Bill 2 played favorites with funding projects in districts that supported Jason Stevens in his bid for House Speaker over Derek Marin. Ms. Cross, you were among those who supported Mr. Stevens in that vote, a move that angered many hardline conservatives.
Jason Stevens is a great conservative leader for the House, and the reason why we wanted to back him is because we knew we would have an adult in the room that had the maturity and the foresight to make sure that they could lead the Ohio House. Being Speaker of the House is certainly not an easy job, something that I thought about doing myself, but then did not do and backed Mr. Stevens to be the Speaker. And I'll tell you why he's the right person for our district is because he cares about Northwest Ohio. Of the five members of the House leadership team, there are two members from Northwest Ohio. Jim Hoops, who serves as the majority whip from Napoleon area, Northwest Ohio, and myself as the assistant majority leader. To have your member of the House serve in leadership puts you all at the table where the decisions are going to be made, where the money decisions are going to be made, the policy decisions are going to be made. We don't give participation trophies away in the Ohio House. To say that there are 16 counties that I don't know how many legislative districts that would be, because, you know, some counties are multiple counties per district. But I thought we did a very nice job spreading the money wisely and well throughout Ohio.
And there's a lot to unpack right here. Again, look up the facts. Democrats only control 32 of the seats, and virtually every single member received funding. Those 16 counties, there are people that didn't support Jason Stevens. Every single person that is being challenged, every incumbent that's being challenged, received a large amount of this money, and 16 counties received nothing. Absolutely, I would have supported Derek Marin. Why? Because I'm a man of my word. If I give you my word in caucus that I'm going to vote a certain way, and you go on the floor, and you betray the party, you betray our community, you get censured by the Ohio Republican Party, and you lose the Ohio Republican Party endorsement. And that's what happened to my opponent. Quite frankly, I'm tired of politicians saying one thing and doing another. And again, we want to say this is all political maneuvering. The reason why he has leadership position is because of this political maneuvering. This is the first time, I believe, in history that sitting state representatives have been censured by the Ohio Republican Party. They just lost their party endorsement. I don't believe it's a speaker issue. I believe it's an issue on integrity and what I see out of our elected officials.
First, we didn't lose any endorsement. Okay, the Republican Party at a county level does not endorse in a primary, and at the state level, they decided not to endorse legislative candidates. They also didn't endorse Jim Hoops and our assistant majority whip, who had nothing to do with who's voting for speaker or not voting for speaker. Again, when words matter, I just asked my opponent, he thinks he's going to tell one side of the story of what happened at the state Republican Party. The endorsements that matter to me are the Ohio Right to Life endorsement, the Ohio Chamber endorsement, the Buckeye Firearms Association endorsement, the NRA endorsement, the National Small Business endorsement. Those organizations and those memberships are the only ones that endorse me in this race. So if you want to worry about whether a state party did or didn't endorse in candidates, what I like to talk about is my record of work and the people seeing my record of work and those organizations and those memberships endorsing my race. I'm proud to have those endorsements and the only candidate in this race to have those endorsements.
Again, I'll ask, this is the first time in history any of this has happened. That's a big deal when the Ohio Republican Party votes not to endorse an incumbent. Again, I stand by what I said. Look it up. Again, I would then ask the Ohio Right to Life endorsement. I would ask my opponent, why is he not endorsed by the local party? The local Right to Life crowd. I have the endorsement of the Ohio Right to Life Coalition with the support of the local Right to Life Coalition. So yes, we can tout our endorsements, and I'm proud to tout my endorsements, and I'm sure you're going to be very impressed with one coming down the road. But again, I'm not here to talk endorsements. I'm here to talk about how we can serve the community, and I'm proud to have my community endorsements with these value-driven organizations.
Let me explain something on the endorsement. The Ohio Right to Life organization, they've endorsed, in some races, two candidates, both the incumbent and the non-incumbent. in this race, I think he's, my opponent's not being very truthful. They did not endorse my opponent in this race because of his statements that he made on medical freedom. There's a document that was floating around about how he is for choice. He is for medical choice. And that doesn't sound like a very pro-life statement to me. So I'm not familiar with the local chapters. I'm the only local chapter I know is there's a local Toledo, Ohio Right to Life chapter. There is no Hancock County, Ohio Right to Life chapter. But the state organization has made a clear difference between me being the pro-life candidate who has supported the heartbeat bill, has supported pro-family and pro-adoption legislation on record voting, and my opponent putting out pro-choice statements from the Medical Freedom Association, whoever they are, and whatever liberal organization that is. So there's a real difference between who's endorsing who in this race. When it comes to pro-life, we are the pro-life candidate in this race.
We talk about experience, and I'm shocked that this is the amount of experience that I'm hearing tonight. Is the Ohio, when we talk about medical freedom, that is talking about your choice to whether you vaccinate your child or not. So to make that sound like that this is a choice of a pro-life issue, I mean, you just got to do your research. And medical freedom is about you making the decision for your child on whether they can receive a vaccine or not. And I'm sorry for the folks out there that are involved with the local Right to Life community out here. I do see you, and I am your voice.
The three Republican candidates hoping to be our next Hancock County Sheriff faced off in the third of our WFIN Candidate Forum series that were held in February and early March. One of the more noteworthy exchanges came from the question of what, aside from drugs, is the greatest challenge facing our community from a law enforcement standpoint? And 2 points came up in response to that question: mental health and the growing diversity of the local population.
Aside from drugs, what will be the next most pressing problem in our community from a law enforcement standpoint, and what would you do to address it? We'll start with Mr. Cortez.
It would have to definitely be our mental health, our community mental health, and not only just the community mental health, but our mental health for our law enforcement officers as well. And so my approach with that is I've met with Family Resource Center and the National Alliance on Mental Illness and discussed what gaps exist between the sheriff's office and the mental health community, and what can we do to work together to better serve the value of the citizens or that demographic of folks that suffer from mental health illnesses. And it's this: we need to embed or integrate a joint effort between law enforcement and mental health professionals so they can have a specialized approach to each and every one of those calls that we encounter.
Mr. Harmon.
So I've been passionate about mental health for 20 years. I've been with the crisis intervention team for that long. I've coordinated the crisis intervention team, which is the one that trains the first responders in Hancock County how to respond to mental health crises. With that, I have actually been to several conferences nationwide. It's not just about law enforcement or mental health. It has to be a combined. I brought this back over 10 years ago where we decided we wanted to have a co-response, where we have trained professionals going out with our law enforcement. And what I've found that it's not actually a trained professional licensed social worker, it's a peer. Somebody that has that peer experience, that lived experience, is one's gonna associate most with people with mental health. I helped create the Veterans Response Team in Hancock County, which is a peer-led organization where we respond to law enforcement requests to send a peer who has military veteran experience. That's where it's at. You know, we have to make sure that we're taking care of these folks on that level.
And Mr. Price.
Both the colleagues have touched on mental health, and that's true. This morning, I worked over an hour and a half to find transport of one of our mental health clients here in the county to find an open bed that tied up a sergeant, a captain, and a deputy holding over from a shift prior. We did make the arrangements, but we got to find a solution. We have to find a way, because jail's not the option. The other thing is some of the immigration issues that we're seeing here in Hancock County is tying up patrolmen and deputies as we struggle to have those communications between each other. We struggle to find interpreters. I sat on a board with the chiefs of the county, working with the courts in order to find out a way that we can accommodate interpreters for the patrol and deputies. We're trying to find ways to get them information through the Department of Public Safety. We're working with the health department. Unfortunately, they're here, and we're struggling to communicate with them. You know, I'm required to have a interpreter that's approved by the higher Supreme Court in order to give them their legal rights. And yes, they still have rights. They are human beings, and we have to find a way to work around it. And we are. It's just not a fast process. It's something we have to be diligent about doing.
Mr. Price, you mentioned growing diversity of our community. It's true that our community, like many in this country, is becoming more and more diverse. Expand on the thought a bit of addressing the challenges that come along with growing diversity in our population.
Over my years, and starting back in 1998, and coming from a small farm community in Wyandotte County, I didn't have a lot of diversity. So my first diversity was Findlay, Ohio. And we all know that there was not a lot here. Times have changed. Times have changed greatly since 1998 in my time and privilege of working here in the sheriff's office. The way we train our deputies is definitely different. The way they're trained in the academy, the way that we promote more training within our inner office, and the conversations that we have are the ways that we're preparing our deputies for those encounters that we have in our community. I feel as a group, as we continue to work together with the public officials, with the community involvement and engagement, to hear those concerns, we can fight back a little bit. But it's going to take time. It's going to take effort amongst everybody. Just because you hold the title of sheriff doesn't mean you have all the answers. But working together with the community, we can make good things happen.
Mr. Cortez.
So back in the 1994, when I first started, I remember having to take a class called Cultural Diversity. It was a education of how to interact with those that are different from us, whether they're African-American or Hispanic or otherwise. Here about 3 years ago, I introduced a program, a training for our deputies called Racial Intelligence. And Racial Intelligence is the approach of being aware of our own biases, whether they're implicit or explicit biases. But what's more important than that is understanding the folks that are coming into our country. And I think that we need to go back and have a better understanding of their culture and what their expectations are, how they interact, you know, what's their norms. And we need to arm our officers with that information and couple it together with that racial intelligence training and be able to have identified resources for these folks that are coming in. That way we can vet those resources out to those individuals that may need our assistance in this community.
And Mr. Hart.
So I was fortunate enough to grow up in a very diverse community from age 7 to 14 in Batavia, Illinois. So when I came to Hancock County, it was kind of a culture shock to me. I've always been taught to accept people for who they are. You're a person first, and then we can talk about our differences, and that's one of the things we have to do, is talk about our differences. You know, we talk about race. That's not the only differences between us. We have religion. We have culture. We have how we were brought up, our families, and, you know, sexual orientation. We have to talk about these things and be open to each other. We don't always have to agree. I can guarantee that. We don't always have to agree, but we do need to start accepting people as people.
This is Good Mornings with Chris Oakes on 1330 WFIN, WFIN.com, and 95.5 FM.
We interrupt this program to bring you a broken news alert.
A Japanese zookeeper dressed up as a white tiger to help his co-workers practice an escaped animal drill recently. I thought, they've got the zookeeper dressed up as a tiger. It's like something out of Calvin and Hobbes, actually. The Tobu Zoo in Miyashiro Town, Japan, holds a yearly training drill where they pretend an animal has escaped. It's actually probably not a bad idea for zoos to do this. but what do you do to simulate an animal having escaped? Well, the zookeeper, tasked with playing the role of an escaped big cat, donned a sweatshirt with a tiger's face on the hood, and then crawled around on all fours as other zookeepers put up nets and tried to subdue him. I don't know. Is this a zoo or an S&M club? I'm not sure. In the event of an emergency, the chief of the zoo said, in the event of an emergency, it is important for each person to understand their role and respond accordingly. Which, again, it's hard to argue with that logic, but here's my question. I would wonder, what is the role of the person who played the tiger if there is an actual tiger on the loose? It's important for everybody to understand their role. So I can just see if I'm the person that, you know, portrayed the tiger. We've got an actual tiger on the loose. Okay, let me get my sweatshirt and I'll crawl around on all fours. And, you know, anyway, what's that guy's role? There's an actual tiger escape. Just thinking out loud here. Some of the other broken news of the day, the odd and unusual side of the headlines. A woman is behind bars after crashing into the ocean at the end of a police chase near the Venice fishing pier in Los Angeles. The woman crashed her SUV into the water early on Sunday, shortly after midnight. She was seen swimming away from the crash site, but didn't get very far. Police threw her a flotation device and then pulled her out of the water with a net. The SUV was then towed out of the water. I'm assuming she was placed under arrest, but the story does not say what she was initially wanted for. What precipitated the chase? But that's pretty good way to end a chase if you drive off the pier into the ocean. So chase is over. Chase is over right there. Speaking of unusual stories involving vehicles, in Jackson, Mississippi, a man described as suffering from extreme mental illness was arrested over the weekend after reportedly stealing a police cruiser. Officers responded to a call about a person off his meds. They say the suspect, identified as Trevin Bell, jumped into their car and drove off. He was stopped by police a short time later and taken into custody. There were no weapons inside the police cruiser, which is probably good. Can you imagine having to call that in? Can you imagine if you respond to a call of somebody off their meds and then you have to call that in and say, he took my car. We have a problem. More from the international file. And again, more traffic fun. A 23-year-old Frenchman who was visiting Norway in search of a job landed a 21-day jail sentence instead after racking up 25 speeding tickets in 19 days. The worst infraction was on February 20th when he was clocked doing 70 miles an hour in a 40-mile-an-hour zone. Although I'm sure it was metric, but that's what it works out to. The man, according to the Oslo District Court in Norway, the man represents a danger in traffic. Local news reports say most of his violations were caught by speed cameras, unbeknownst to the driver. The man's sentence was reportedly reduced by 3 days after his full confession, but his license has been suspended for a year, and I would guess that is going to make his job search that much more difficult. I think he's probably not going to get whatever job he was in Norway trying to land. You can probably forget about it. Probably isn't happening. And finally, in the broken news this morning, also from the international file, a man in Montreal, or a man from Montreal, came back to his home city from a trip to Costa Rica, only to find that the government had declared him dead. Well, not exactly. It was a bit of a clerical error. Nick Futuros received a letter from the Ministry of Justice attempting to collect money from his estate. So he gets back from vacation to a letter from the government trying to collect taxes from his estate. And Mr. Futuros said, I laughed out loud. And he said, that's news to me that I am dead. Apparently, said the 34-year-old said he forgot all about the speeding ticket that he contested all the way back in 2022. And that's what this stems from, this unresolved speeding ticket from 2 years ago. He then went on an extensive trip to Latin America, and while he was gone, the government decided to collect on this overdue speeding ticket. He had contested it, but the case hadn't been resolved, and so after 2 years, the government said, well, we're just going to collect on this. The Ministry of Justice said the mix-up was due to human error, explaining that the collector of fines mistakenly used a letter template used to correspond with an estate rather than the template that is normally used to communicate with a defendant. So instead of defendant, it said estate on it. So they didn't necessarily declare him dead, but it was certainly a shock when he got home from vacation. And his attorney has said that fortunately, this didn't go any further because it really could have caused some serious problems on down the line. He is still contesting the fine. We don't know how it will all be resolved, but at least the government has acknowledged that he's not dead. So, I don't know, at this point, I'd pay the fine and take the small victory. At least you're not dead. You know, that's... Pick your battles there, guy. There you go. Some of the odd and unusual headlines in today's Broken News Report. We now return you to your regularly scheduled programming.
When the rumors are flying, getting the facts matters more than ever. At WFIN, we're your trusted source and will always present the story only after verifying the information with trusted sources. This is WFIN News Director Matt Demchek. Trust in us to present just the facts when covering events impacting Findlay and Hancock County. You can depend on us to get the story right every time on social media, 1330 WFIN, WFIN.com, and at 95.5 FM.
And now your daily download, the numbers behind the news and the statistics that shape our lives. According to a new survey of 2,000 employed Americans, 70% believe that the modern workplace is stuck in the last century. This is a survey conducted by OnePoll on behalf of the Financial Technology Association. And some interesting results here, a lot of data to unpack. Nearly 100 years after the inception of the Monday to Friday work week, 57% of those in the survey say that the traditional 5-day 9-to-5 no longer works for them. And there's certainly been, in recent days, some talk with the bill that Bernie Sanders introduced in Congress of making a 4-day week work week the standard instead of 5-day. 57% apparently would agree, at least on some level. Not only that, another 67% of respondents believe that the traditional pay period of every 2 weeks or every other week or twice a month is also outdated. More than half, 51%, believe that a rigid structure is best left in the past and a lack of flexibility in the workplace is no longer up to date. Given the choice, employed Americans in the survey are more likely to opt for more frequent pay than a more flexible work schedule. So if they could only have one, they'll take more frequent pay, 50 to 44%, which I think is kind of interesting. Currently, 51% of Americans are paid every other week, 23% get their check weekly, and 14% actually only get one paycheck monthly. 7% of those in the survey say they are paid daily for their work. And that in some businesses has become popular, daily pay, but only 7% have that structure currently. 62% of respondents say that their current pay cycle doesn't fit their current financial situation. And 61% believe it's because they're living paycheck to paycheck or because they run out of money too quickly. 52% say they run out of money too quickly. More month at the end of the pay as opposed to the other way around. 56% always or often find themselves stretching their income between pay periods. And the average employee runs out of funds just 12 days after they receive their paycheck. And especially important when it's 2 weeks apart. Which is kind of interesting that they also found 27% of workers actually have access to a program called Earned Wage Access, which is where employees can actually receive part or all of their paychecks before payday if they need it. 27% have access to this, although only 16% have actually used it. Now, finally, in our Election Day special edition of the program this morning, recapping our WFIN Candidate Forum series featuring the individuals running in contested local races in the Republican primary, the last of our candidate forums ahead of today's primary featured Hancock County Commissioner candidates Jeff Wobser, Jeff Hunker, and Holly Frische. We jumped right into the conversation with the question of whether there is actually a need for a new jail facility, and more immediately, what happens when the new building to house the probate and juvenile court is completed.
When it is fully operational, it will bring up the question of what to do with the current building that houses the probate and juvenile court. What do you believe should be done with that facility once it is vacated? And for this one, we'll start with Mr. Wobser.
I think that building, much like the situation with the jail, is kind of a multi-leg issue. You've got to look at the historic value of that, although there's only a really small portion of that building that is historic. The rest of it was added on to over time. Does it serve a better purpose in a historic value? There will be a group of people in our community that I guarantee you will step up and will want to see that remain there for that specific reason. Or is that land better utilized for something else? For instance, could it be a parking garage? Boy, kind of hate to say that from the standpoint of taking a historic building and turning it into a parking lot. But I think it's going to take a lot of conversation. There's no easy answers to that. Much like the jail, it's going to take a lot of conversation and discussion amongst all the different groups. We've got issues that we'll have to continue to look at. It's going to be a beautiful building. It's going to serve a great purpose. But we know we've got parking issues that are coming with that.
Mr. Hunker.
Unlike Mr. Wobser, I don't see that as a difficult decision. That building, knowing the county's budget and all the needs that the county has right now, and the budget being tight as it has been. I mean, right now there's some surplus there, but there are going to be needs and cost with this new building. Anytime you build new, as many of the schools have found out, it's not cheap to run a new building. So my decision, my vote, is that the building comes down. I honestly see the value, I see the architectural beauty of it, but there comes a time when you have to make tough decisions, and in my eyes, and having what I think is an understanding of the budget, I think there's a lot more higher priorities than that, honestly, so I see the building coming down.
And Ms. Frische.
Well, I don't see the building coming down per se. I think we are still in those discussions of having a parking plan, a downtown plan, and how we're going to operate together with the city. With that being said, there's still use for a lot of those buildings. I would love to see the county work together with the city because we are limited on our space in the municipal building, and there could be some needs there. I think parking is a separate discussion from that, and I don't think we should jump too quickly to think tear it down, make it parking.
Which brings us to the next big question when it comes to county facilities. You have all brought up the needs of the Hancock County Jail, both tonight and during your campaigns. During our forum last week, however, the Hancock County Sheriff candidates all downplayed the need for a new jail. When asked, they did not cite that as an immediate or desperate need. So we'll ask you, from your perspective, how significant of a priority do you view this to be? And we'll begin with Mr. Wobser.
The jail situation is a multi-tentacled monster. We have the current jail, which needs upgrading. It's 30 years old. We've spent quite a bit of money on maintenance on it. It's going to cost us a lot of money going forward. And to get it up to speed, it's going to cost quite a bit. But we don't know what that cost is yet versus building new. There's a lot of people that think that building out on 140 is the best place to be. That may be the case. But the fact of the matter is we don't know yet what that is. Right now, the jail is about 70% capacity. That's for a couple of different reasons. Number one, the city took their business elsewhere. Part of the reason that the city no longer houses inmates there is because of the cost. The daily cost is cheaper to go someplace else. And also, there was a period of time when staffing, which is still a problem with the corrections officers, the sheriff asked us to move our people out, which we did, and we've just chose not to come back at this point. The city has not. So there's a lot of things that are going to go into the decision to make that jail. It's a very expensive proposition, somewhere between $90 and $150 million. It is not going to be an easy decision, and that will be one, if we go forward, that will have to require almost every bit, every person in our elected government to be involved in that, to have their input so that we do the right thing.
Mr. Hunker.
Though I feel that a jail is needed, based on my knowledge, my experience walking through the jail personally, my experience talking to individuals that work daily in the jail, ultimately, that's a decision that's a community decision. I serve on the Community Action Committee studying potential new jail. There will be an upcoming recommendation coming out soon. That committee has worked very diligently to come up with answers. But let me be clear. Currently, I see no path moving forward with the Justice Center under the current financials in the Hancock County budget. Therefore, the judges, the sheriff's office, police department, other elected officials are going to have to work together, try to come up with something. And there needs to be open and honest discussion. And based on the decision that comes down, that decision will be from the citizens of Hancock County before a vote. And it may be a ways away, but that's the way it has to proceed.
Ms. Frischig.
The jail is a big discussion. It's multifaceted. We're going to have a new sheriff in town. I'm excited for that. Any of the three candidates, it's going to be great. We're going to see a lot of things going on. And the first thing we're going to have to figure out is staffing the jail, improving our road workers and so forth, our deputies. And then we have to talk about where we want the jail to go and what the community wants the jail to be. Do we want it to be in downtown? Do we want it to be on 140? Are we willing to pay for that tax increase to get it done? But we are maintaining that jail. We are doing maintenance to that building as we speak. So we're not ignoring the facility and letting it crumble. So I think that is important to know as well.
And that will finish off our podcast for today. Remember, polls are open until 7:30 this evening on this primary election day. You can view our candidate forums in their entirety on our Facebook page, and we'll have complete election results as the vote comes in tonight at WFIN.com and at goodmornings.net. Coming up tomorrow morning on the program, a salute to service, celebrating Women's History Month by highlighting the evolving and expanding role of women in the U.S. military. So until tomorrow morning, that is Good Mornings for this morning. Now that you've had a good morning, go on out and make it a good day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.